Today on Against the Grain, Donald Trump infamously targeted immigrants, and many rejoiced when he left office. But as historian Elliot Young points out, the criminalization of immigrants has been a bipartisan affair, going back 140 years. He discusses the intersection of mass incarceration and the detention of immigrants. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Criminalizing, detaining, and deporting immigrants is neither a new practice nor restricted to the Republican Party. Instead, as Elliot Young argues, all go back a century and a half in the United States, which he writes about in his book, Forever Prisoners, How the United States Made the World's Largest Immigrant Detention System, published by Oxford University Press. He teaches history at Lewis and Clark College, and he's one of the founding members of the Migration Scholar Collaborative. Elliot, how are two of the biggest issues of our time, that is, the increase in policing and mass incarceration and immigrant detention, how are they linked?
So the increase in policing in mass incarceration began, I mean, one could argue, and I do in the book, that you can go back all the way to the late 19th century and see this, but in recent times, it's really from the 1980s and 1990s that you begin to see laws passed that are increasing mass incarceration, increasing policing of communities of color, particularly Black and Brown communities. And at the very same time, you have the increasing enforcement of immigration laws and then the linking of those immigration laws to criminal laws, so that if someone gets picked up on a misdemeanor charge or some kind of low-level offense, that could have drastic implications for one's immigration status and ultimately lead to deportation. So what we've seen over the last 30, 40 years is an interlocking of the criminal law and immigration law in something that people now call crimmigration.
The argument that you make in your book is one that we need to, while of course being aware of the intensification of these processes in the last several decades, that in fact we need to take a much longer look to understand the criminalization of immigrants in the United States. So I wonder if you can take us back to the very early days in which the federal U.S. immigration system was established. When did detentions and deportations start?
So federal immigration doesn't begin until 1882 with the Chinese Exclusion Act, and the very same year they passed the General Immigration Act. And in the very early years, they do not have a bureaucracy set up to either detain, deport, or deal with much enforcement of the immigration laws. By the mid-1880s, you start to get pressure from labor unions on the West Coast, xenophobic groups that are pushing for the enforcement of the Chinese Exclusion Act. And so you get Chinese being picked up in places like Tacoma and being sent to prisons like the prison in McNeil Island off the coast of Tacoma in Washington, and being sentenced to hard labor for essentially for an immigration violation, for being present in the country without authorization. That is completely unconstitutional and illegal because they had not gone through a criminal trial and they're being sentenced to a criminal sentence. So in that case, in Tacoma, these scores of Chinese are being put into prison, and the authorities tried to deport them back to Canada. They had come through the land border in Canada and crossed over into the United States. But Canada at that point had established a head tax for Chinese coming across. And since the Chinese did not have the money to pay the head tax, the Canadians refused to accept them. So the Chinese were basically stuck in indefinite detention on this prison island off the coast of Washington indefinitely. Finally, the U.S. government engages in diplomatic correspondence with the Canadians. They're unable to resolve the situation. And then in 1890, they begin deporting Chinese directly back to China. So that begins this process of deportations, not only across the land borders, but over the Pacific Ocean back to China. And we see from that moment on a kind of linking up of the criminalization of migration to this machinery of detention and deportation. And what happens, 1896, the Supreme Court says you cannot sentence someone to a criminal sentence without going through the due process. So they essentially make this rule which says that holding immigrants pending deportation in detention is not imprisonment in a legal sense. So essentially they create a loophole where they can imprison immigrants and not give them due process rights. And we see the impact of that up till today, where immigrants in immigrant detention have very limited due process rights. And there have been multiple occasions over the course of the 20th century when immigrants have been held indefinitely for years. And if we think about the people in Guantanamo for decades without any criminal charges.
What was the importance of mental hospitals in the early 20th century as a site for the detention of immigrants and non-immigrants?
Yeah, so in the book, what I try to do is not just focus on immigrant detention per se, but to look at all of the ways that immigrants, the foreign-born, were locked up in the United States. And what I discovered, to my surprise, that at the beginning of the 20th century, immigrants, and this goes for citizens as well, were much more likely to be locked up in a mental asylum, mental institution, than they were in either a prison, a jail, or for immigrants in immigrant detention. And so the mental hospital became the main way that immigrants were locked up. And when people were put into these mental hospitals, most of them were essentially sentenced to life terms there. And so not only were the vast majority of people put into these institutions, but they would be held there for long periods of time. And then what we see happening after 1940, and especially after the 1960s, is the mental hospitals emptying out. And then we begin to see the rise in mass incarceration. So what we've done, if we look now at the prisons, is we've essentially warehoused people who have mental health problems in prisons and jails. But if you look at the rates of institutionalization or incarceration, it's actually quite similar at the beginning of the 20th century to our present moment of mass incarceration. It's just different kinds of institutions in which people are held.
So would it be fair to say then that through the 20th century to the present, we've had mass incarceration, it's just been in different institutions?
I think we've had ebbs and flows in mass incarceration. Definitely there is a dropping off point, 1940 through the 1960s, where the rates of institutionalization incarceration go down, but then they go back up. So if you look at the first part of the 20th century, it looks a lot like the latter part of the 20th century.
You just mentioned the 1940s, and I wanted to ask you about an FBI program during World War II that sought to kidnap and deport Japanese
German and Italian people from Latin America, and rather than deporting them from the U.S., they were being deported into the United States. Can you tell us about that program?
Yeah, so this was a semi-secretive program run by the FBI out of U.S. embassies in Latin America, and the idea was that Germans, Italians, and Japanese, who were, those were the Axis powers during World War II, that citizens of those countries that lived in Latin America could form a fifth flank and be part of the war effort and be spies for the government. And so they created these blacklists of people, the FBI did, who they would then, with the cooperation of certain Latin American countries, arrest those people at gunpoint, put them on U.S. military transport ships, and bring them into the United States to be held for detention. Now, there was no evidence. Almost none of these people were connected to the government at all. And so these are simply people who were living in Latin America who happened to be of Japanese, German, or Italian descent and were put on these lists largely because of economic rivalries within those countries. So they would end up getting put on the list by their enemies and then brought to the United States. Their passports would be seized on the U.S. military transport ships. Then when they landed in the United States, the U.S. government said, "You have entered the United States without authorization." So the technical reason why they were being held, the legal reason, was actually for illegal entry. And the absurdness of this situation, just continues to boggle my mind that it is the U.S. government that is forcing them to come to the United States and then claiming they've entered illegally. So then those people, thousands of Japanese Peruvians in particular, is the story I follow, were held in detention centers run by the Immigration Naturalization Service, the predecessor to ICE, in Texas and New Mexico for years. And the program was meant to be a program that would exchange these prisoners for American citizens being held by the Axis powers. So it was really kidnapping pawns to be exchanged for Germans, Italians, for American citizens in being held by the Axis powers. Those exchanges never ended up coming to fruition, and so these people just languished in jail for the duration of the war. And even after the war, the Japanese Peruvians, who were not allowed back to Peru, did not want to return to war-torn Japan, remained in prison years after the war had ended.
How do you relate the U.S. policy with this FBI program targeting Latin Americans of Japanese, German, and Italian descent? How do you relate that to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II?
So I think the commonality there is anti-Asian, anti-Japanese racism that criminalizes people just based on their descent and believing, therefore, they would have political affiliations with the Japanese government. But these two kinds of internment or detention were very different. One, the Japanese American internment was run by the War Relocation Authority, so the Defense Department, whereas the Japanese Latin Americans, German, Italian Latin Americans, were being held under the auspices of the INS or the Immigration Naturalization Service. So those two were very different. And then in the 1980s, when there were efforts to recognize the wrongness of Japanese American internment, the Japanese Latin Americans were specifically cut out from that agreement and did not receive reparations because they said they had no no rights because they essentially were not in the U.S., were not U.S. citizens, and therefore they could not make claims to the reparations that the Japanese Americans had received.
I'm speaking with historian Elliot Young. He's the author of Forever Prisoners, How the United States Made the World's Largest Immigrant Detention System, as published by Oxford. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you mentioned that in the 1960s, mental institutions were phased out. And then following that, one saw the increase again, if one looks over the trajectory of the 20th century, of mass incarceration. Can you tell us about the detention of Haitians and Cubans in the 1970s and 80s and how you see their detention within this larger story of the criminalization of immigrants in the United States going back 140 years?
So in the 1970s, Haitians who are escaping political violence in their country, as well as poverty and economic dislocation, are coming into the United States. They are being picked up, and instead of being granted asylum, they would have been eligible for asylum. They are routinely denied asylum, and they are put in detention camps and eventually sent back to Haiti. What starts with the Haitians then builds when in 1980, a group of 125,000 Cubans fleeing Cuba in what is called the Mariel boatlift come into Florida. And instead of the previous policy, which had been any Cuban who arrived in the U.S. was essentially paroled into the U.S., given papers, allowed to work, this group of Cubans was poorer than the Cubans who had come in the early 1960s. They were darker. They were seen as criminals and as mentally ill and sort of stigmatized as a group. And so as a group, they were put in detention camps, mass detention camps, housed on military bases in the United States and processed there. Within a few months, most of the people who had family connections in the United States were paroled out. The people who had family connections tended to be the whiter Cubans because their families had come fleeing Castro's revolution in the early 1960s. The ones who remained tended to be darker skinned, of lower socioeconomic background. So some of those people were continuously held from 1980 all the way up through the end of the 80s. Another group of people was paroled out into the United States. And in the meantime, while they're living in the United States, some of them had committed low-level offenses, mostly drug possession charges. Some had assault charges as well. So they completed their prison sentences, their criminal sentences, and immediately were declared ineligible for remaining in the United States. So they were ordered deported and put in prison. Most of these ended up in the Atlanta Penitentiary, and they were being held indefinitely because the Cubans refused to take back to receive these deportees. So essentially, when a deportation happens, there needs to be an agreement from the receiving country that they will take the people back because of the bad relations between the United States government and the Cuban government. The Cubans simply refused to take them back. And so these people ended up also in indefinite detention in Atlanta Penitentiary, and they were also being held in Oakdale Detention Center. Some of them were being held in McNeil Island Prison, that prison which had held Chinese immigrants in the late 19th century. So there is a sort of echo of the past where we have in the 1980s Cubans being held in the very same prisons that held some of the first immigrant detainees on the continent.
Tell us about the uprising that took place, or uprisings, I should say, in 1987 by these prisoners in Atlanta and in Oakdale, Louisiana, only a decade and a half after Attica.
Yeah, so what happens is the U.S. government is negotiating with the Cuban government to try to deport these people that had been held. There were something like 2,200 of them that had been held for years and years. Again, these people are not facing criminal charges. They're simply being held until they could be deported. And those people had, the incarcerated Cubans had protested their incarceration, saying, "We came to this country for freedom, and all of a sudden we find ourselves locked in these prisons without any access to due process. And having committed, you know, having, if we committed crimes, we've served out our sentences for those crimes." So the U.S. government is able to negotiate a deal with the Cubans to take back a group of about 2,000 of them. When the Cuban inmates in Oakdale, Louisiana, and in Atlanta hear this, they immediately think they're going to be deported back to Cuba. And many of them had expressed anti-government opinion in Cuba. Some of them had actually been in prison in Cuba prior to leaving the country. And so they were very afraid of being returned to Cuba. So in Oakdale first, they rise up. They take over the detention center. They seize hostages. And then a day later, the same thing happens in Atlanta Penitentiary. By the time it's over, in the two detention centers, they had seized over 100 guards as hostages. They had torched some of the buildings, and they were demanding that they not be deported to Cuba and that they each have individual reviews of their cases so that their asylum claims could be heard. So there is a standoff with the FBI, the Border Patrol, the Army sort of surrounding the prison. And there's really a question of whether we would see another Attica-like invasion of the prison. And there were tense moments. They were flying helicopters over the prison. The Cubans, you know, said that if they did invade, they threatened to kill the hostages that they had. Ultimately, through negotiations, by bringing in a Cuban American bishop from Miami, and also with the intervention of some of the legal aid lawyers who were working with the Cubans in Atlanta, they were able to come to an agreement with the U.S. government where the U.S. government would individually review all of their cases, and the Cubans finally accepted this deal, and none of the hostages were harmed. In the end, one of the Cuban prisoners, detainees, was shot and killed by prison guards in Atlanta in the first few hours of the takeover, but overall it ended relatively peacefully. The problem is what happened to those Cubans is they were then dispersed through prisons throughout the country, and many of them experienced retaliatory violence against them by prison guards who were basically taking out against them as revenge the fact that they had taken over the prison. So there are testimony of people who were made to sleep on floors, handcuffed and shackled for days at a time, and even beaten by guards. Eventually, they go through these individual reviews, and by the early 1990s, they actually start deporting some of these Cubans back to Cuba. And sadly, the Cubans who return from prison from the United States end up being put directly back into prison in Cuba, And so they're in Cuba, they suffer a different but similar kind of criminalization as they had in the United States.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with Elliot Young. He's professor of history at Lewis and Clark College and the author of Forever Prisoners, How the United States Made the World's Largest Immigrant Detention System. That's published by Oxford, and you can find a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. Elliot Young is one of the founding members of the Migration Scholar Collaborative. So for a lot of historians of immigration, the 1980s is a pivotal moment. In fact, a lot of history start then. You obviously choose to start much earlier. You see continuity with the past going back 140 years. But I wanted to ask you what took place of such significance in the 1980s in terms of looking at the detention and criminalization of immigrants?
So in the 1980s, the experience that had happened with the Cuban detainees and the prison uprising, I believe, sparks legislation by the U.S. Congress, which increasingly seeks to criminalize immigration. So you begin to get in 1988 laws that are ostensibly drug laws, but in those anti-drug laws, you have immigration implications so that if someone has committed certain kinds of offenses, they are ineligible for asylum. And they create also in the late 1980s this concept in the immigration law of an aggravated felony. And an aggravated felony is something that is doesn't exist in criminal law, but it's kind of invented in immigration law to say that certain kinds of offenses will prevent you from being able to get asylum and stay in the country. Over the next 10, 15 years after that, they expand the category of what an aggravated felony is, and it becomes retroactive. So in one of the cases that I look at, someone who had written a hot check when she was 18 years old, that is considered an aggravated felony. And on that basis alone, that person was unable to receive asylum in the United States. So what happens in the 1980s, partially as a result of the uprising by the Cubans in the prison, but also at the same time, a series of criminalization laws that increasingly criminalized Black and Brown citizens in the United States through anti-drug laws, is that immigrants were increasingly being caught in between the criminal justice system or the criminal legal system and the immigration system. And it's important to understand why is it that this happens with the Cubans and the Haitians in the 1970s? Like, what had changed? The Cubans and the Haitians are largely a Black population that comes over. And so this is the connection to the rise in the drug war and mass incarceration of citizens, which is also largely directed at Black and Brown men. And so that's where these two systems overlap. And what we see is that in impact, the immigration enforcement, detention, deportation is almost entirely about incarcerating and imprisoning Black and Brown immigrants and deporting them. And so, you know, the earlier waves, if we look after World War II, of people who were given asylum, they're Europeans and they're white people. But in the 1980s, that shifts and immigration enforcement is essentially directed almost entirely against Black and Brown, largely men, but also women.
Well, let's talk about how that criminalization of immigrants and expansion of incarceration and the targeting of people of color has intensified in the last decades. Can you tell us about what happened under the Obama administration and the integration of local police into immigration enforcement?
Those of us who have, you know, just lived through Trump, I think, were rightly very focused on the incredibly xenophobic, racist language that Trump used regarding immigrants. But having a broader historical perspective, you can see that these policies were not developed or invented by Trump, that this has been a bipartisan policy for a very long time. And under Obama specifically, the laws and to basically deputize local law enforcement as immigration agents expanded. So those laws had existed since the 1990s, but under Obama, they vastly expand. And what that means is that when an immigrant is picked up on some kind of low-level charge, they automatically, the local police would be running the information through the immigrant databases to see if these people were in the country legally. And if they were not, they were automatically put into deportation proceedings. So that connection between the criminal justice system and immigration enforcement under Obama is tightened and connected more tightly, and that ends up leading to the largest number of formal deportations in the history of the United States, far surpassing what Trump was even able to do in his 4 years in office.
Tell us about the case of Mayra Machado, who you mentioned in passing. You were an expert witness in her case, and what her case illustrates about precisely the kind of intensification that you've been describing.
So Mayra Machado, in some ways, is the through line of this entire book. The book starts off with her story, and it ends with her story. So Mayra was brought to this country by her mother as a five-year-old. The mother was escaping political violence in El Salvador, and it's important to note the U.S. government's involvement with supporting the Salvadoran government that was massacring people, killing Jesuits, and so U.S. foreign policy essentially helped to create the situation that drove migrants like Mayra and her mother to the United States. So she grew up in California, for all intents and purposes, as an Americanized kid, you know, speaking English, all the rest of it. When she's 18 years old, living in Arkansas, she makes a mistake and writes a hot check, a fraudulent check, and is caught and is charged with a felony for doing so. She's young. At the time, she's pregnant. The judge gives her a six-month sentence in some camp so that she could be rehabilitated. She serves her time, and that's the end of it. You know, this is someone who has done something wrong and has served their time. So for 10 years, she's living. She has no criminal convictions. And then in 2015, a decade later, she's picked up on a minor traffic violation, brought down to the local police station. And there, because of Obama's expansion of these policies or programs which deputize local law enforcement, she is found to be in the country without papers and immediately sent to detention in Louisiana and is held there until, you know, pending deportation. And from Louisiana, from this detention center that's run by Geo Corporation in a very rural part of Louisiana. She tries to fight for asylum. I was contacted by a lawyer to serve as an expert witness case about country conditions in El Salvador, and she was denied asylum. While her appeal was still pending, she was deported to El Salvador. When she arrives in El Salvador, she is immediately harassed and threatened by government officials, by gangs, threatened with sexual assault, and is facing a very dangerous situation in El Salvador. She's also separated from her three U.S. citizen children who are back in Arkansas with her mother. And so after a few months of living in fear in El Salvador, she returns to the United States, again, without authorization. She lives for another year in Arkansas, and then again is picked up on a low-level traffic violation and is charged with illegal reentry and put into deportation proceedings again. And so I received a phone call from Myra in the spring of 2019 while I was writing this book, and she was at that point representing herself. She did not have a lawyer, and she asked me whether I would be willing to help her case. So I immediately agreed and secured her a pro bono lawyer from Loyola University, a law school professor, Isabel Medina, and we fought her case. She petitioned for asylum. The immigration judge denied her asylum claims, totally ignoring all of the expert witness documentation I'd provided about the threat against her in El Salvador. And that was appealed to the Board of Immigration Appeals. She was denied there. And then it was appealed again to the Fifth Circuit District Court. Again, while her appeal is pending, in January of 2020, she was deported for a second time to El Salvador. And it's worth noting that asylum is entirely dependent on which jurisdiction you're in and which judge you happen to get. In Louisiana, it is almost guaranteed that judges will deny asylum claims. There are some judges that have something like 99, some have a 100% denial rate. So essentially, no matter what the claim is, no matter what the evidence is, those claims will be denied. So today, Myra is living in San Salvador. She is working to try to reunite children in El Salvador with their parents who have made it to the United States. But she is still separated from her three children in Arkansas, and she is working to try to get back to reunite with them. And if there ever could be a poster child, poster person for asylum, I think the case of Myra Machado would be among them. And it's important to remember that although Myra is an extraordinary human being representing herself, advocating for herself, that she represents millions of other people who have been caught in this web of criminalization of immigrants and people who are not a danger to U.S. society, who have been deported and separated from their families, and causing tremendous harm to themselves as well as the communities to which they belong.
I'm speaking with historian Elliot Young about his book, Forever Prisoners, How the United States Made the World's Largest Immigrant Detention System. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let me ask you, Elliot, about the current situation on the U.S.-Mexico border under the Biden administration. How should we understand it within the longer trajectory of U.S. detention of immigrants?
So there's been a lot of hope that Biden would reverse Trump's policies and have a new vision for immigration. And to some extent, I think certainly the rhetoric has changed. Biden has ended the Remain in Mexico policy, which essentially sent asylum seekers back to dangerous situations in Mexico while they waited for their court hearings to happen. So he's done good things like that. On the other hand, he has maintained a policy that Trump started called Title 42, which allows the government, without any due process or hearing before judges, to return people coming across the border seeking asylum to Mexico based on the claim that they pose a danger because of the COVID pandemic. And so that is one area where we see continuity between Biden and Trump. And it's disturbing that that's the Biden administration would continue that policy, which is so clearly denying asylum seekers due process. We also have the situation of large numbers now of unaccompanied minors being held in detention under conditions that are not safe, that are not healthy, for longer than 72 hours, as the court has mandated. They can only be held for 72 hours. The Biden administration claims it's that they don't have enough process, the ability to process these people in time. But there's simply no excuse for putting traumatizing children and keeping them in those kinds of facilities. The United States is the richest country in the world, and certainly they have the bureaucratic ability to process these thousands of asylum seekers who are children on the border and not to keep them for so long in these detention centers. And I think those of us who have seen the excuses from Republican and Democratic administrations just have to not accept that, that they're just children, should not be put in cages, should not be held for long periods of time. We know that it traumatizes them over the long term, and these children do not pose a danger to the country. And so in that sense, I think the Biden administration still has a long way to go to changing the whole approach to immigration, which should be one of welcoming people into the country, following the laws to grant asylum seekers the ability to petition for asylum, and not creating these bureaucratic obstacles as they continue to do.
Given the 140-year-old history of immigrant detention in the U.S., what do you make of the call to abolish the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE?
I call it a good start, but one of the things that I note, having that historical perspective, is that before ICE, there was the INS, the Immigration Naturalization Service, which did much the same thing. So what I don't want to see is just a new agency with a new name that is doing basically the same thing that ICE is doing, doing the same thing that the INS is doing. So what we need is a transformation in how we think about immigration, rather than thinking about immigration as a threat to the United States, as criminals trying to get in. We should think about an immigration system that tries to help immigrants that are coming into this country to get access to healthcare, education, to integrate into the society. And right now, what ICE does and what the entire immigration system does is criminalize immigrants and seek to keep them out or keep them in positions of marginalization in our society.
For those who would like to oppose the continuation of the detention of immigrants. Do you think that there is a need to link what often are separate struggles against immigrant detention with struggles going on in society against policing and mass incarceration? And if that were to happen, what might it look like?
Yeah, it's something that I came to, you know, first by looking at immigrant detention and then realizing that the struggle of immigrants, say, for sanctuary, is completely connected to the struggle to transform our criminal justice system. So I'll give you an example. In Portland, the city declared in 2017 that the city was a sanctuary city. So what that meant is local law enforcement would not be involved in immigration enforcement, the thing that had landed Mayra Machado in deportation proceedings. But all of those sanctuary jurisdictions, and they exist across the country, are great. The problem is that if someone is picked up by the local police for any kind of infraction, brought to jail, their information and fingerprints are then entered into a system that ICE monitors. And so de facto, the criminal justice system is so interlocked with the immigration system that what we need to do is address the problems of broken windows policing, which is the enforcement of very low-level offenses, largely against Black and brown people, that leads them into the system, the criminal justice system in the first place. And if we don't break that link at the front end, then no matter what kind of sanctuary policies your city has, they are going to be vulnerable to ICE agents who are out there to find these people, arrest them, and deport them. And so I think there is an exciting moment where trying to transform policing at the local level can be connected to the immigrant rights movement and really see that this is a common struggle, that all of our interests are bound up with stopping the over-policing of Black and brown communities. Everyone will be safer if we do that. And our neighbors who are immigrants, our neighbors who are Black and brown, will all be living in much safer communities if we could just transform policing and really redirect it towards solving violent crimes rather than harassing people for very low-level offenses.
Let me end by asking you, given that this history that you've been mapping out has been this history of mass detention of immigrants and now mass incarceration of immigrants and non-immigrants has been bipartisan, in terms of thinking around the sort of questions that you're now talking about struggling over how policing takes place or whether it takes place and how incarceration takes place. Do you think that there are openings right now, as well as maybe perils, in that a lot of people, as you've noted, have thought that with the end of the Trump administration that there might be the possibility of some kind of sea change around these questions when you are saying that Trump has just been part of a larger thread of punitive policies towards immigrants and non-immigrants around incarceration?
Yeah, so I'll give you the hopeful part first. The vast majority of people in the United States, when surveyed, actually have a very positive view of immigrants. And surprisingly, this actually increased during the Trump years. So I think in terms of where the people are at in the United States, there is a lot of hope that the people in the United States understand we need to change our immigration policies. There are generally positive views. People want a pathway to legalization, if not citizenship. But I think on the negative side, the focus on this immigration bill and getting it through Congress is we shouldn't spend a lot of our political resources doing that because it doesn't seem like the votes are there. It needs to get too many Republicans in the Senate to pass it. And Obama spent a lot of political capital trying to get some kind of immigration reform through and did it at the expense of increasing the militarization of the border, increasing deportations. And so what he ended up with is not getting comprehensive immigration reform, but actually increasing the harm to immigrants. And so I think what we need to be pushing for is thinking about that long-term comprehensive immigration reform. But what Biden can do is through executive orders, through changing rules, change the enforcement priorities of ICE so that basically they are not focused on charges like illegal entry, illegal reentry, and picking up people for very low-level offenses. The vast majority of people prosecuted today in the federal system are prosecuted for illegal entry and reentry charges. These are basically charges that criminalize the act of migrating without authorization. Prosecutors routinely have discretion about which laws they enforce, and it would be very easy for the Biden administration to basically give the directive that they're not going to prioritize the enforcement of those laws, and that would go a long way towards decriminalizing the act of migration.
Elliot Young, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Elliot Young is author of Forever Prisoners, How the United States Made the World's Largest Immigrant Detention System. That's published by Oxford University Press at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to it. Elliot Young is professor of history at Lewis and Clark College and one of the founding members of the Migration Scholar Collaborative. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.